Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode 69. It's Saturday, July 4th. I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. I am not celebrating Independence Day. Rather, I am celebrating Interdependence Day, in hope that we can work together to address our mutual problems and protect one another's health and well-being. Sadly, the number of COVID-19 cases is skyrocketing nationwide, and the vast majority of states are experiencing much rising cases. Our nation's epidemic is not a few hotspots. We are a raging inferno of infections. Our faltering patchwork of timid restrictions has brought us to a spot worse than the beginning of the spike in March. Our too little, too late responses and our denial of the risks of reopening have converted a flattening of the curve into an epidemic multiplying by multiples. Our refusal to accept that gaining control of this epidemic is a precondition of gaining control of our economy is causing us to lose both health and a functioning economy. We have squandered the intense cost of shutdowns on premature and ill-advised reopenings. The time bought by shutdowns has brought neither adequate testing capacity nor widespread and robust contact tracing capacity. Our leadership is so poor nationally and statewide that we have no national consensus even on mask wearing. And so the epidemic rages on. The first wave reignites before we are even prepared for a second wave in the fall and winter. Schools must prepare for the worst, with hundreds and hundreds of school districts largely having to figure it out for themselves, and hundreds of colleges and universities readying themselves for a largely uncontrolled and massively dangerous social experiment, where we are the guinea pigs or lab rats. After all, this is America. And we have the freedom to choose if we are guinea pigs or lab rats.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little, too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Have you ever wondered where OSHA is amidst this raging pandemic, where health and workplaces are the nexus of national success or failure? Well, this from NPR. Many say OSHA not protecting workers during COVID-19 pandemic. Thousands have complained to OSHA about unsafe working conditions due to COVID-19. OSHA has not inspected a single workplace. NPR's Scott Simon speaks with Deborah Berkowitz, a former agency official. The mission of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, known as OSHA, is to protect American workers. But many healthcare workers, factory workers, transit workers, and others have said they do not feel protected during the pandemic. What has OSHA been doing? Deborah Berkowitz, a former senior OSHA official, says the agency has been doing nothing. There have been no workplace inspections, no legal threats, no fines. We asked her about the thousands of COVID-related complaints OSHA has received. What has she said? In this pandemic, OSHA has decided, really, not to enforce the law. Federal OSHA has received, about 18,000 complaints from state OSHAs, and they have already closed 12,000 complaints that they have received from terrified workers. OSHA simply sent a letter to the employer and said, "You have to investigate yourself. We don't have any real specific requirements." And then the employer would write back, "We're doing what we can," and OSHA closes the case. This is unprecedented. Whenever there's been an emergency or crisis, OSHA has always done some enforcement to let workers know that the agency has your back. Because if OSHA doesn't act, workers can't sue an employer. So OSHA, right at the beginning of the pandemic, decided they weren't conducting inspections. And not only that, but that they weren't going to publish any specific requirements that employers had to comply with. So there are no requirements to protect workers from COVID-19. No requirements for keeping workers 6 feet apart or giving workers masks or giving the ability to wash their hands repeatedly. OSHA and CDC have guidelines, but OSHA's not enforcing them. In some states, the governors have implemented executive orders because the federal government has totally failed here. Okay, well, let's move from the national scene and ask the question, where are we locally in Lucas County and statewide in Ohio? Well, in Lucas County, in the most recent 7-day period, we have seen more than a doubling of cases compared to the previous 7 days. We have gone from 60 to 131 cases. In Ohio, we have cracked over 1,000 cases each of the last 3 days, a level unseen since April, when Ohio set national records with 2 huge prison outbreaks. Statewide, cases have more than doubled in less than 3 weeks. So, what is our allegedly great governor doing about this steady and large increase in cases? This from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio implements county-by-county advisory system for COVID-19. The state announced an advisory system for COVID-19 that will attempt to measure the amount of virus in each county through a set of indicators. The system, the governor said, will allow for businesses to remain open even as cases continue to rise across the state. "It's clear the virus once again is spreading with a vengeance across Ohio and the country," the governor said. Quote, "We cannot move back, Ohioans. We cannot move back. Ohioans have come too far in this fight to cede ground to the virus," DeWine said. "This next phase is not about hunkering down, but how we learn to live with the virus." Well, at least we can document this unfolding catastrophe with colorful and numbered alerts. Well, I can guarantee you that Corey the coronavirus is celebrating Independence Day this year. Thank you, Governor DeWine, for making Corey an esteemed honorary citizen, free to travel our great state and great businesses, and free to surf our citizenry.
"Hi, I'm Corey the coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
So, of course, amid this pandemic, the wealthiest nation in human history is bolstering its public health infrastructure. That is not the case. This from Kaiser Health News. The U.S. public health system has been starved for decades and lacks the resources to confront the worst health crisis in a century. Marshaled against a virus that has sickened at least 2.6 million in the U.S., killed more than 126,000 people, and cost tens of millions of jobs and $3 trillion in federal rescue money, state and local government health workers on the ground are sometimes paid so little that they qualify for public aid. They track the coronavirus on paper records shared via fax. Working 7 days a week for months on end, they fear pay freezes, public backlash, and even losing their jobs. Since 2010, spending for state public health departments has dropped by 16% per capita, and spending for local health departments has fallen by 18%, according to a Kaiser Health News and Associated Press analysis of government spending on public health. At least 38,000 state and local public health jobs have disappeared since the 2008 recession, leaving a skeletal workforce for what was once viewed as one of the world's top public health systems. Kaiser Health News and the AP interviewed more than 150 public health workers, policymakers, and experts, analyzed spending records from hundreds of state and local health departments, and surveyed state houses. On every level, the investigation found the system is underfunded and under threat, unable to protect the nation's health. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, said in an interview in April that his biggest regret was that our nation failed over decades to effectively invest in public health. So when this outbreak arrived, and when, according to public health experts, the federal government bungled its response, hollowed out state and local health departments were ill-equipped to step into the breach. Over time, the workers received so little support that they found themselves without direction, disrespected, ignored, even vilified. The desperate struggle against COVID-19 became increasingly politicized and grew more difficult. State, cities, and counties in dire straits have begun laying off and furloughing members of already limited staffs, and even more devastation looms as states reopen and cases surge. Historically, even when money pours in following crises such as Zika and H1N1, it disappears after the emergency subsides. Officials fear the same thing is happening now. We don't say to the fire department, "Oh, I'm sorry, there were no fires last year, so we're going to take 30% of your budget away." That would be crazy, right? Said Dr. Gianfranco Pizzino, the health officer in Shawnee County, Kansas. But that's what we do with public health, day in and day out. Ohio's Toledo Lucas County Health Department spent $17 million, or $40 per capita, in 2017. Jennifer Gottschalk works for the county as an environmental health supervisor. When the coronavirus struck, the county's department was so short-staffed that her duties included overseeing campground and pool inspections, rodent control, and sewage programs, while also supervising outbreak preparedness for a community of more than 425,000 people. When Gottschalk and five colleagues fell ill with COVID-19, she found herself fielding calls about a COVID-19 case from her hospital bed, then working through her home isolation. She stopped only when her coughing was so severe she couldn't talk on calls. "You have to do what you have to do to get the job done," she said. Now, after months of working with hardly a day off, she said the job is wearing on her. So many lab reports on coronavirus cases came in, the office fax machine broke. She faces a backlash from the community over coronavirus restrictions, and there are countless angry phone calls. Things could get worse. Possibly county budget cuts loom. But Toledo-Lucas County is no outlier. Public health ranks low on the nation's financial priority list. Nearly two-thirds of Americans live in counties that spend more than twice as much on policing as they spend on non-hospital health care, which includes public health. More than three-quarters of Americans live in states that spend less than $100 per person annually on public health. Spending ranges from $32 in Louisiana to $263 in Delaware, according to a data provided by Kaiser Health News and AP by the State Health Expenditure Dataset Project. That money represents less than 1.5% of most states' total spending, and half of it passed down to local health departments. The share of spending devoted to public health belies its multidimensional role. Agencies are legally bound to provide a broad range of services, from vaccinations and restaurant inspections to protection against infectious disease. Distinct from the medical care system geared toward individuals, the public health system focuses on the health of communities at large. Public health loves to say, when we do our job, nothing happens. But that's not really a great badge, said Scott Becker, Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Public Health Laboratories. We test 97% of America's babies for metabolic or other disorders. We do the water testing. You like to swim in the lake and you don't like poop in there? Think of us. But the public doesn't see the disasters they thwart, and it's easy to neglect the invisible. The Affordable Care Act established the Prevention and Public Health Fund, which was supposed to reach $2 billion annually by 2015. The Obama administration and Congress raided it to pay for other priorities, including a payroll tax cut. The Trump administration is pushing to repeal the ACA, which would eliminate the fund, said Carolyn Mullen, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs and Public Relations at the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Former Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, a Democrat who championed the fund, said he was furious when the Obama White House took billions from it, breaking what he said was an agreement. I haven't spoken to Barack Obama since, Harkin said. If the fund had remained untouched, an additional $12.4 billion would eventually have flowed to local and state health departments. But local and state leaders also did not prioritize public health over the years. In most states, the new budget year begins July 1st, and furloughs, layoffs, and pay freezes have already begun in some places. Tax revenues evaporated during lockdowns, all but ensuring there will be more. At least 14 states have already cut health department budgets or positions or were actively considering such cuts in June, according to a Kaiser Health News AP review. Since the pandemic began, Michigan temporarily cut most of its state health workers' hours by one-fifth. Pennsylvania required more than 65 of its 1,200 public health workers to go on temporary leave, and others lost their jobs. Knox County, Tennessee furloughed 26 out of 260 workers for 8 weeks. Friedan, formerly of the CDC, says it's stunning that the U.S. is furloughing public health workers amid a pandemic. The country should demand the resources for public health, he said, just the way it does for the military. Cincinnati temporarily furloughed approximately 170 health department employees. Robert Brown, chair of Cincinnati's primary care board, questions why police officers and firefighters didn't face similar furloughs at the time, or why residents were willing to pay hundreds of millions in taxes over decades for the Bengals football stadium. How about investing in something that's going to save some lives, he asked. In 2018, Boston spent five times as much on its police department as its public health department. The city recently pledged to transfer $3 million from its approximately $60 million police overtime budget to its public health commission. Looking ahead, more cuts are coming. Possible budget shortfalls in Brazos County, Texas, may force the health department to limit its mosquito surveillance program and eliminate up to one-fifth of its staff and one-quarter of immunization clinics. Months into the pandemic response, health departments are still trying to ramp up to fight COVID-19. Cases are surging in states, including Texas, Arizona, and Florida. Meanwhile, childhood vaccines began plunging in the second half of March, according to a CDC study analyzing supply orders. Officials worry whether they will be able to get kids back up to date in the coming months. In Detroit, the childhood vaccination rate dipped below 40% as clinics shuttered and people stayed home, creating the potential for a different outbreak. Cutting or eliminating non-COVID activities is dangerous, said Oscar Alien, Chief of Programs and Services at the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Cuts to programs such as diabetes control and senior nutrition make already vulnerable communities even more vulnerable, which makes them more likely to suffer serious complications from COVID. Everything is connected, he said. It could be a year before there's widely available vaccine. Meanwhile, other illnesses, including mental health problems, are smoldering. The people who spend their lives working in public health say the temporary coronavirus funds won't fix the eroded foundation entrusted with protecting the nation's health as thousands continue to die. I would just note, one thing I really like about this article is that it juxtaposes spending on, for instance, police, along with public health and other social services that protect our community in other ways than threatening violence. So let's include public health in the array of defunding police departments and returning that money to vital social programs that'll make us truly safe, truly healthy, and enhance the well-being of every person in our community. Okay, next up from Times Higher Education. Women in science are battling both COVID-19 and the patriarchy. Successful female scientists are, by definition, resilient. We have overcome well-documented barriers throughout our lives, discouragement by teachers, family, and society to pursue careers in STEM fields, a lack of role models, hostile and sometimes abusive work environments, disproportionate domestic work and caring responsibilities, and biases against us in favor of men in every aspect of professional lives, hiring, promotion, publishing, pay, service loads, and grant allocation. These barriers are felt even more keenly by women of color, who face the intersectional effects of racism and sexism. And yet, even these lifelong battles for a place in science have left us unprepared for the gendered and racial inequalities we have experienced in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The worst impacts of the coronavirus will undoubtedly be the loss of lives, the collapse of economies, the disruption of humanitarian aid, and the decay of democracies. But we fear the hard-won progress for women in science will be collateral damage of this crisis. Together, we represent scientists in North America and Europe who are working on COVID-19 both through research and in the translation of research into clinical responses, policy, and public communication. We span the academic career pipeline from graduate students all the way up to senior tenured faculty. We all share the same experience. The scientific response to COVID-19 has been characterized by an extraordinary level of sexism and racism. In some ways, the issue we face represents an exacerbation of the inequalities we have always had to manage. But what is surprising and demoralizing is seeing the fault lines of sexism that define our unequal footing with men crack into gaping chasms under the pressure of the pandemic. Women are advising policymakers, designing clinical trials, coordinating field studies, and leading data collection analysis, but you would never know it from the media coverage of the pandemic. More than ever before, epidemiologists, virologists, and clinicians are communicating with journalists and the public about their science. But highly visible articles in the New York Times and other media outlets about the scientists involved in the responses are biased towards men. Even though there are plenty of qualified women on the front lines of the COVID-19 response that could easily be identified by checking author lists and scientific websites. Neither epidemiology nor medicine are male-dominated fields, but women are quoted less often, sometimes not at all, in articles. What's more, the lack of inclusion of leaders of color is striking and disenfranchising for minority women scientists of color, particularly as communities of color are being hit hardest by this epidemic. Even within our own institutions, unqualified men's voices are being amplified over expert women because they have been identified through informal male networks or have blustered their way into social media and TV interviews and are therefore perceived as high profile. Not including women's voices in the public discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic is a distortion of reality. It not only perpetuates the invisibility of women in science and leadership positions, undermining our ability to be taken seriously as experts and failing to provide role models for younger women, but also impacts our careers as we strive to prove the impact of our work to funding agencies, colleagues, and hiring or promotion committees. We have also noticed that women are more likely to be doing work that is focused on getting, quote, BS done. Can't say that on the radio, I guess. The operational work and supporting decision makers, for example, rather than writing scientific papers or grants. All the while, we are disproportionately supporting students and filling service or pastoral roles in our institutions, a continuation of a troubling trend of women doing the invisible work in academia, even in the absence of a pandemic. At the same time, we see that the opportunistic but not necessarily qualified researchers who are applying for newly available COVID-19 funding are overwhelmingly male. This is not only skewed in favor of men, and often fails to acknowledge junior women involved, but also represents a misallocation of funds. And then there is the potentially dangerous issue of unqualified men being listened to more than women experts, reflecting the fact that white male power structures seem unable to entrust the most important public health questions to anyone other than white men, regardless of their qualifications. Management consultants, largely male, with negligible relevant experience are making key decisions about the health of millions. Tech sector data scientists with no prior experience in any aspect of public health, biology, or disease control are being, quote, pulled in to task force to discuss the finer points of contact tracing with policymakers. Senior male academics, famous for their innovations in other spheres, are giving public commentary with ill-informed modeling exercises, conjectures, or policy prescriptions with no basis in rigorous science. For many women, the final straw is the inequality they face in domestic work, child care, and responsibility for aging parents and community members. There is ample evidence that women faculty spend significantly more time doing household chores and looking after children than their male counterparts. Now, with almost all of us working from home and schools closed around the school, the burden of the responsibilities, particularly child care, falls heavily on women. We already know that this discrepancy plays out in terms of academic productivity, where equal maternity and paternity leave policies come with a deficit for women and provide a boost to men. Now there's evidence of the productivity divide during the COVID-19 crisis, with fewer women submitting papers than men, which we suspect reflects both the type of academic work women are doing and the time deficit created around trying to balance work with increased domestic responsibilities. Even the crucial medical research into COVID-19 is male-centric. As women who are deeply involved in COVID-19 science, it's become clear to us that our expertise means little when it comes to real decision-making in this public health emergency. We are frustrated that our work is being overlooked and misrepresented in the media. We're exhausted knowing that after this is all over, we will have a powerful fight on our hands to reclaim the professional ground that is slipping away from us during this emergency. And we fear that these experiences will lead to a hemorrhaging of women from academia in the aftermath of this pandemic, particularly junior women, even with assurances of tenure, clock stoppages, or other mitigating policies. The disillusionment and cynicism we hear in the voices of our colleagues and friends fills us with sadness. "After this is over, I'm done," is a refrain we have heard many times in the past few months, almost exclusively from women. We are reticent to complain for fear of being seen as weak, as if we are overly fixating on prestige or whining about being left out, when in fact the stringent filters of sexism and racism have left us all with tougher skins and greater resilience than many of our male colleagues. Potential solutions to these problems have been proposed and discussed many times. Changes in promotion criteria, targeted funding opportunities, raising awareness among journalists, and mandated inclusion of diverse speakers on academic panels. While urgently needed, these solutions are insufficient to respond to the amplification of inequalities that the pandemic has brought. We need to deeply examine these issues and to reflect seriously on the cultural and institutional toxicities they expose. No doubt this article will provoke predictable responses. Accusations that we are elitist, we are entitled, we have our priorities wrong, we are overreacting, we are paranoid, and it's hashtag not all men. Meanwhile, many of our male colleagues will send us well-meaning private messages of encouragement, asking which women to follow on Twitter. Journalists will ask us who to interview and if we can provide a list of options. The answer is yes, of course. There are lists of female experts, there are author lists on scientific papers, and there are academic websites. These exist precisely because we have been fighting for years to progress science in spite of patriarchal barriers. We wish that we could now focus on fighting COVID-19. Okay, well, in public health, we need to be aware of a lot of isms. That one was sexism. Now let's move to racism. This from Stat News. "Structural racism is why I'm leaving organized psychiatry. The killings of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and so many others are leading many Americans to reflect on structural racism in society and resolve to do things differently. They have led me to make the difficult decision to end my membership with organized psychiatry, specifically the American Psychiatric Association. After years of committing myself to the APA and believing that organized psychiatry was an effective vehicle by which progress could be made, racism is driving me and other black physician leaders out of organized psychiatry, just as it has pushed black physician leaders out of academic medicine. As a physician, I grew up in the APA. During my residency, I was selected to receive the APA GlaxoSmithKline Fellowship, now known as the APA American Psychiatric Association Foundation Leadership Fellowship. Its goal is to prepare future leaders in the field of psychiatry. I was delighted and proud until I read the press release bearing the headline that 10 residents had been awarded the fellowship, yet only 9 names were listed in the release. The name of the only black person in the fellowship class, mine, was left off. I was hurt, but didn't feel at the time the need to correct this, quote, oversight, and remained silent. The fellowship itself exposed me to the many opportunities that the American Psychiatric Association had to offer. I met important colleagues, mentors, and leaders with whom I still collaborate. In 2007, through the fellowship, I attended the APA's annual meeting in San Diego. There, for the first time, I attended a black psychiatrist caucus meeting and heard the pain and frustration of my colleagues who were deeply committed to organized psychiatry, but felt strongly that organized psychiatry did not have the same commitment towards them or their patients. At that meeting, I learned that black psychiatrists had stormed the APA Board of Trustees meeting in 1969, demanding racial equity. 1 year later, a collection of 7 articles on racism appeared in the American Journal of Psychiatry. It included clear recommendations for white psychiatrists to become increasingly aware of how their everyday practices continue to perpetuate institutional white racism in psychiatry and to support the search for realistic solutions, and to make available the necessary resources of money, manpower, and authority, and not just in the current token amounts. Unfortunately, these recommendations were not followed in any significant way, despite the fact that they are still as relevant today as they were 50 years ago. I left the APA's 2007 meeting vowing to continue to fight for racial equity from within the organization. Over the next few years, as a junior faculty member, I dedicated myself to this effort. I submitted abstracts on topics related to improving outcomes for minority populations with serious mental illnesses. I was careful, though, in how I presented these issues in submissions to the APA's annual meeting scientific program committee. I hid my interest in minority issues through coded language such as health disparities and social determinants of mental health. Many times, despite my great efforts to make my interests more palatable to a wide audience, these submissions were rejected. I found acceptance with the Institute on Psychiatric Services, IPS, APA's smaller fall meeting, which is marketed for public sector psychiatrists, those who primarily care for poor patients of color. I began to incorporate discussions about discrimination into psychiatry into my submissions for this meeting. Presentations that were routinely rejected for the APA's annual meeting were often accepted and well-received at these IPS meetings. I was grateful to have the IPS as an outlet to grapple with complex issues of structural racism in psychiatry. Sadly, prominent APA leaders have expressed concern that IPS unfairly caters to one group of the APA, public sector psychiatrists, and have explored the financial viability of continuing the IPS meeting. My direct interactions with APA leaders made me wonder about gaslighting. I often questioned whether unwritten policies were deliberate attempts to impede progress towards achieving racial equity. As co-chair of the 2018 workgroup on the future of the IPS meeting, I and other members of the group volunteered extensive time to develop 6 recommendations to ensure the financial and logistical stability of future meetings, only to be left doubting if any of these recommendations were ever realistically considered. For the first time in my career, no IPS meeting was scheduled for fall 2020, a decision made long before the emergence of COVID-19. I've also experienced countless microaggressions. APA leaders have confused me with other black women psychiatrists bearing no resemblance to me, interrupted one-on-one conversations I was engaged in without acknowledging my presence to speak with a white man I was conversing with, and have accidentally forgotten to acknowledge me when publicly recognizing members for their service to the organization. In each instance, I remained silent. I did not want to make a big deal out of something that seemed so small. Over time, I realized some leadership roles in the APA. I am a distinguished fellow of the APA and serve several terms on the IPS's Scientific Program Committee. I'm a member of the editorial boards of the APA Publishing and the journal Psychiatric Services. I have gained much from these experiences, especially under the excellent leadership of these publications' editors-in-chief. I participated in the APA mentoring program, although curiously, I've never been paired with a black resident, despite firsthand knowledge of how essential this type of early connection is to career development. I encourage residents to apply for the APA Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration Minority Fellowship. even as the APA has quietly instituted unwritten policies that race and ethnicity cannot be considered in selecting minority fellowship recipients, and despite there being no federal mandates that uphold this policy. These practices had the subtle effect of making it more difficult for psychiatry residents who are underrepresented in medicine to receive these fellowships, although I can't point to any verifiable evidence available to support the suspicion, leaving me again to question whether I'm being gaslighted. Although the discrimination I have personally experienced is a problem, the real issue is structural racism, which the Aspen Institute defines as, quote, a system in which public policies, institutional practices, cultural representations, and other norms work in various, often reinforcing ways to perpetuate racial group inequity. Organized psychiatry has repeatedly refused to examine its contribution to the system. It has not prioritized the need of minority patients, especially black patients. In our mental health system, people of color are overrepresented, misdiagnosed, and mistreated, and organized psychiatry has no plan to guide the correction of these well-studied and long-standing inequities. Although there is adequate representation of black psychiatrists on the APA's Board of Trustees, there are no people of color on the Executive Committee of the Board of Trustees, the highest level of leadership in the organization. The organization's most critical leadership position for undoing structural racism in psychiatry. The director of the Division of Diversity and Health Equity has been vacant for more than a year. Attempts to give voice to psychiatrists who are underrepresented in medicine resulted in the creation of an elected minority and underrepresented trustee who serves on the APA Board of Trustees. Unfortunately, the APA has expanded the concept of underrepresented in medicine beyond the traditional definition of the Association of American Medical Colleges to include women and international medical graduates, groups not traditionally underrepresented in psychiatry. The end result is that all identity groups that are not heterosexual white males are pitted against each other to vie for representation and a voice in leadership. Common arguments for lack of appropriate representation in leadership include low numbers of qualified black psychiatrists and other psychiatrists of color. Yet, when Dr. Altha Stewart became president of the APA in May 2018, the only black president in the organization's 176-year history, she appointed many psychiatrists of color to prominent leadership positions throughout the organization. Sadly, these gains did not persist once her one-year term ended, so recent public statements and town hall events about the APA's commitment to ending structural racism seems disingenuous. I will miss the aspects of my professional identity that were forged in organized psychiatry, but I look forward to a time in the future when APA leadership truly understands that the structural racism that pervades the organization must be dismantled. There are clear steps that can be taken. A reasonable plan was eloquently articulated 50 years ago in the organization's flagship journal. What is needed now is financial commitment coupled with accountability to implement action to begin to systematically dismantle structural racism in organized psychiatry. I've decided, however, that I can no longer fight this battle. I choose to devote my time and loyalty to organizations that share my values and my commitment to achieving racial equity. Even so, I look forward to the day that I can return to the organization that I grew up in and owe so much to, after I am assured that it has made significant progress in addressing systemic racism. I have been afraid to speak out because of fear of what it might mean for my career, but I can no longer be silent. My colleagues of all races, ethnicities, and identities have inspired me to use my voice to affect change. I often use this quote from poet and activist Audre Lorde in presentations, but I realize today that I also need to live by it. When we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard or welcomed, but when we are silent, we are still afraid, so it is better to speak.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, one of the many mournful things in the spikes recently across the nation is that as we're preparing for the fall, schools and universities were getting ready to go back, and these continuing spikes will make it very difficult to do that safely. So this from the New York Times: expecting students to play it safe if colleges reopen is a fantasy. A number of American colleges and universities have decided to bring students back to campus this fall, believing they can diminish the risk of coronavirus transmission if everyone wears masks, uses hand sanitizer, and social distances. Some schools also plan to reconfigure dorms to create family-sized clusters of uninfected students who could socialize in relative safety, if only with their suite mates. These plans are so unrealistically optimistic that they border on delusional and could lead to outbreaks of COVID-19 among students, faculty, and staff. My skepticism about the strategies under consideration is not based on videos of college students frolicking on Florida beaches when they were explicitly told to avoid large gatherings. Rather, it comes from more than 40 years teaching and researching young people. Most types of risky behavior, reckless driving, criminal activity, fighting, unsafe sex, and binge drinking, to name just a few, peak during the late teens and early 20s. Moreover, interventions designed to diminish risk-taking in this age group, such as attempts to squelch binge drinking on campus, have an underwhelming track record. There is little reason to think that the approaches proposed to mitigate transmission of the coronavirus among college students will fare any better. A series of studies that compare the ways in which young people and adults think and make decisions about risk-taking confirms this. The late adolescent peak in risky behavior has been found pretty much around the world. Although risky behavior is more common in some countries than others, the heightened risk-taking characteristic of adolescents relative to adults is more or less universal. My colleagues and I recently completed a study of more than 5,000 people between the ages of 10 and 30 from 11 different countries, including both Western and non-Western ones. Respondents answered a series of questions about the extent to which they engage in various types of risk-taking. Consistent with large-scale epidemiological studies, we found a peak in risk-taking somewhere between age 20 and 24 in virtually every country. We also conducted a series of experiments designed to identify just what it is about college-age individuals that accounts for their relatively greater propensity to take risks. Three factors appear to be most important. First, this is the age at which we are most sensitive and responsive to the potential rewards of a risky choice relative to the potential costs. College-age people are just as good as their elders at perceiving these benefits and dangers, but compared with older people, those who are college-age give more weight to the potential gains. They are especially drawn to short-term rewards. Second, college-age people have more trouble exercising self-control than those in their late 20s and beyond, an age difference that is amplified when people are emotionally aroused. Under calm conditions, college-age individuals can control their impulses as well as their elders, but when they are emotionally aroused, they evince the poor self-control of teenagers. Finally, college-age people show more activation of the brain's reward regions and are more likely to take risks when they are with their peers than when they are alone. There is no such effect of peers among people who are past their mid-20s. Not all adolescents are risk-takers, of course, and not all adults are risk-averse, but it's hard to think of an age during which risky behavior is more common and harder to deter than between 18 and 24. The people in this age make up about 3/4 of full-time American undergraduates. And in case it's been a long time since you were in college, let me remind you that there's no shortage of rewarding temptations, emotional arousal, or unsupervised peer groups on the typical college campus. It's one of those perfect storms, people who are inclined to take risks in a setting that provides ample temptation to do so. My pessimistic prediction is that college and university reopening strategies under consideration will work for a few weeks before their effectiveness fizzles out. By then, many students will become cavalier about wearing masks and sanitizing their hands. They will ignore social distancing guidelines when they want to hug old friends they run into their way to class. They will venture out of their, quote, families and begin partying in the hallways with classmates from other clusters, and soon after, with those who live on other floors in other dorms or off campus. They will get drunk and hang out and hook up with people they don't know well. And infections on campus, not only among students, but among adults who come into contact with them, will begin to increase. At that point, college administrators will find themselves in a very dicey situation with few good options.
I look forward to a time when we are able to return to campus and in-person teaching, but a thorough discussion of whether, when, and how to reopen our colleges and universities must be informed by what developmental science has taught us about adolescents and young adults think. As someone who is well-versed in this literature, I will ask to teach remotely for a long time. Oh, sorry, for the time being. Well, with this article, which I think is very good about the science of development and risk-taking by different age groups, I do think that it's been way overblown as far as kind of focusing all of the driving of this epidemic as being young people. Clearly, they're holding their own as far as like not following different practices and stuff. But I think the mistake, this mistake actually comes mostly out of the desire to minimize the reality that we're dealing with and just the natural impulse to kind of blame others. I think that the thing that in conjunction with it that makes this particularly dangerous is that, you know, while we live in a somewhat stratified society, the fact is we intermingle among all ages, at least plenty enough for the virus to move around quite ably. Now, of course, between these stratifications, say between young and old, sure, it might take a couple cycles of viral replication among, say, young people before it hops into older people, but you're talking about days and weeks, maybe months at most. So in the course of a pandemic, it's almost meaningless. It will move around. So let's look at young people realistically and plan accordingly, but let's not blame them. Why don't we just do universal recommendations and actually develop consensuses within our culture of things that we should do, like social distance and wear masks? And let's all sacrifice for the benefit of all. Okay, well, I'd like to close the show on a follow-up on a story I did in the last episode, and also props to young people, since we kind of just diss them. Perhaps they're a little bit, some people might see it that way. Last week, I talked about the problem with getting water on the Navajo Nation, and this article from Stat News. As COVID-19 tears through Navajo Nation, young people step up to protect their elders. Michelle Tom stared into the screen. The Navajo doctor had just finished a grueling shift at the Winslow Indian Healthcare Urgent Center facility in Winslow, Arizona, caring for COVID-19 patients. Now she was spending her Friday nights speaking via live stream to Native American youth about the pandemic. "I've seen it hit everyone," she said of the coronavirus, "but I have the strength of my ancestors, the strength of my prayers, and the strength of all of you. We have to keep talking about it, especially to our young people." In recent weeks, similar messages have resounded around the Navajo Nation as younger generations have come to play a pivotal grassroots role in the pandemic response. They have moved quickly for good reason. Navajo residents have been devastated as the virus has swept through a reservation that spans four states with the highest infection rate of anywhere in the U.S. Young Navajos are motivated in large part by a desire to protect their elders, many of whom have underlying health conditions and who are at high risk of COVID-19, and the vital cultural knowledge they carry. Frustrated by the federal government's slow response and worried about their loved ones, they have mobilized to provide health information, assistance, and supplies so their elders can stay safe at home. These efforts have been key as the Navajo Nation struggles to contain the pandemic across its vast lands. "What's sacred to us is our elders," said Allie Young, a 30-year-old screenwriter who grew up in the Navajo Nation outside Shiprock, New Mexico. "And tied to our elders are our language and our traditional practices, stories, and culture. With this virus, there's a threat to that, because when our elders are dying, that knowledge goes with them. That we're still learning. The virus has proven particularly difficult to combat on the reservation, where many families live in multi-generational households that make social distancing and quarantining harder. These challenges are compounded by the weeks-long wait for federal aid from the CARES Act to arrive as the pandemic raged. Young Navajos, sensing that help could not wait, are now leading a variety of response efforts, from donation drives to deliver much-needed water and food, to social media campaigns to reach isolated residents, to recruiting medical volunteers to staff clinics. Young, who recently moved from Los Angeles back to Shiprock to be with family, knew it was critical to communicate with elders as the deadly virus spread. She also knew that would be difficult, given that some residents lacked internet access and even electricity. So she created a social media campaign called Protect the Sacred that instead targets tech-savvy young people in the hope they'd bring accurate information about the virus to their own loved ones. Since launching in late March, Protect the Sacred has held 3 live streams featuring Navajo healthcare professionals like Tom, political leaders, and celebrity allies such as actor Mark Ruffalo and filmmaker Taika Waititi. The celebrities draw young people in, but public health officials have been able to use the panels as a way to dispense advice and beg young people to stay home. Even as young as you are, you can be a transmitter if you're not careful. It's up to you to protect yourself, your community, and your elders. Jill Jim, executive director of the Navajo Nation Department of Health, warned Navajo youth during one of the sessions. Building on the success of Protect the Sacred, Young and Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez recently rolled out another campaign, hashtag Navajo Strong, to collect financial donations and recruit badly needed medical professionals. Before a 57-hour curfew locked down the reservation recently, Young, Nez, and a caravan of volunteers, including Chef Jose Andre and actor Sean Penn, donned masks, bright green vests, and gloves to deliver supplies to more than 500 families. Like Young, Kyle Jim, a 32-year-old Shiprock resident who works with nonprofits, realized the hardships his people faced early on. As the virus hit, he grew deeply concerned after seeing his neighbors flood the town's only grocery store. Although he knew the tribal government was providing some aid to communities, he knew many families were falling through the cracks. The reservation also relies on emergency assistance from 110 local chapter houses, which were closed due to the virus. He feared some residents, especially those without transportation, would struggle to get food or other essentials. So Jim and his 24-year-old sister, Bree Lehman, who returned home from the University of Arizona when the pandemic hit, launched another Northern Dine COVID-19 relief effort. They quickly rallied young community leaders, organizers, and volunteers to help identify what families needed and to solicit donations, from baby supplies and cleaning products to fresh produce and water. In the 10 weeks since they began, they've assisted more than 600 families. As they traveled across the reservation over the past 2 months, they found that there's also a need to resolve confusion about COVID-19. A lot of people don't know what the coronavirus is, Lehman said. They think it's a simple cough or a flu you get over. The grassroots relief efforts among young Navajos has also stretched to those living afar. Miranda Bayale, who works in a fifth grade classroom in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, watched in alarm as the virus began sweeping through her homeland. After Bayale and her siblings moved their 62-year-old mom from Shiprock to Bayale's one-bedroom apartment to keep her safe, Bayale and a colleague who is also Navajo decided they needed to do more. We felt a sense of obligation to put our young minds into action, said Bayale, who is 32. After starting a relief drive through their school's parent-teacher association, they were swamped with precious supplies like hand sanitizer, wipes, shampoo, books, toys, and school supplies. They then put together care packages, which were delivered to dozens of families around Shiprock. They even received a donation of dozens of boxes of Girl Scout cookies for nurses on the front line, each tagged with an inspirational message. Bayali's brother, Graham Bayale, helped ferry the boxes to the Northern Navajo Medical Center. Graham, like so many other young people, has looked for ways to protect not only his community, but also his own family. Before the virus struck the reservation, Graham was living with some cousins and their elderly parents. He quickly moved out and into a tent on some farmland he is cultivating with friends to grow crops. But like countless Navajo families affected by the pandemic, the Bayale siblings have not been spared. Their father collapsed on Mother's Day after being infected with the virus. He remains hospitalized and on a ventilator, his family unable to visit. For the Bayales and many others in their generation, the intensely personal nature of the crisis has become a call to action. That's been true as well for Heather Tanana, a 37-year-old lawyer who lives in Salt Lake City. She felt helpless watching the virus tear through her birthplace and threatens her own family. Her 73-year-old father, a Navajo physician, works at an Indian health services clinic in Monument Valley and is one of the few doctors who speaks Navajo. One of 8 children with a large extended family, Tanana has also had loved ones fall to COVID-19. Every time we lose one of my dad's siblings, one of our elders, it is really disheartening, she said. Tanana and some colleagues who volunteer on the Indian Child Welfare Act Committee were talking about how to help the community when they came up with a plan. After reaching out to her network and local health and social service agencies, she launched Utah Tribal COVID-19 Relief. All of us have had full-time jobs, but we are either personally or professionally connected to tribal communities, she said of her 11 partners. A good portion of us are Native members who are worried about our families on the reservation. The group posted a long wish list online for donations. Cloth masks, diapers, thermometers, bottled water, and more. And also asked for financial contributions. The response was more than Tanana even envisioned. They collected enough supplies to fill two large trucks and raised more than $15,000. But the success has been bittersweet. Just 2 weeks ago, Tanana's 76-year-old grandmother died in a nursing home near Gallup, New Mexico, of COVID-19. The day she found out, one of her partners sent her a photo of the logo for a new relief drive for the Navajo Nation. In a time of darkness, it made me feel joy that people would do that for individuals they don't know, she said. Initially, Tanana's project was going to last 2 weeks, but because of the halting response from the government and the ongoing uncertainty about the pandemic, she and her partners are considering whether to continue their work. Everyone expects the need to be there, she says. There's a lot of attention now. But what about in the fall? Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, T-O-P-P-U-N.com. You can queue up this show, re-listen to this show, or queue up future shows going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT.
Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some